Debussy, Beethoven and Chopin. BBC Radio 3, 90 to 93 FM on digital radio and online. It's 1 o'clock and this is David Cornett with a summary of the news. The Prime Minister is coming under pressure to name a judge to lead the public inquiry into newspaper phone hacking allegations. Labour has said that it's worried that evidence could go missing once the News of the World is shut down tomorrow, but News International has denied reports that millions of emails from an internal archive at the paper were destroyed earlier this year. Rupert Murdoch is flying to London to deal with the growing crisis. A 63-year-old man who was arrested yesterday in connection with allegations that corrupt payments were made by journalists to police officers has been released on bail. Tens of thousands of people have witnessed the formal declaration of independence of South Sudan. The crowds danced and sang as the country's flag was raised at the tomb of John Garang, who led the fight against the North. The Disasters Emergency Committee says £6 million have been donated by the public to help millions of people affected by a severe drought in the Horn of Africa. The money will be used to provide food, water and medical treatment to people in Ethiopia, Kenya, Somalia and South Sudan. A member of the Afghan intelligence service has shot and killed two American soldiers and injured a third. The intelligence official was then himself shot dead in the incident in the northern province of Panjshir. MPs have criticised the way that rail services on the East Coast Main Line were renationalised in 2009. The service was taken into public ownership after the operator, National Express, opted out of the contract. The Public Accounts Committee said National Express had been allowed to get away scot-free. Betty Ford, the widow of the former US President Gerald Ford, has died at the age of 93. She was best known for founding a leading California clinic for treating drug and alcohol addiction. And the weather, it'll be generally cloudy across the whole country with some sunny spells across England and Wales. There'll be some showers everywhere, which could be heavy in places. BBC News and Weather at 1:02. And time now, as promised, to join Catherine Bott for the early music show, which begins with music by Thomas Tallis, performed on The Virginals by Lawrence Cummings.
Like as the Doleful Dove by Thomas Tallis, keyboard music from the very first volume of Musica Britannica, established in 1951 to be an authoritative national collection of British music. The original plan was for just 10 volumes. As it celebrates its Diamond Jubilee, the number is 90 and counting. 1951 was also the year of that tonic to the nation, the Festival of Britain. And I'm off to the 2011 York Early Music Festival very soon, where we'll be recording concerts of music specially prepared to reflect the early music content and context of 60 years ago, including, of course, the founding of Musica Britannica. To find out more about this monument to our musical culture, I've come to the offices of its publishers, Stainer & Bell, in a quiet residential street in North London. And with me to tell the story, I'm very happy to say, is the best possible guide, musicologist Julian Rushton, Emeritus Professor at Leeds University and Chairman of the Editorial Committee of Musica Britannica. Julian, what was the original aim of Musica Britannica?
The original aim was expressed, somewhat unfashionably nowadays, as publication of the classics of our music, but excluding certain composers who were going to get privileged treatment, that is, collected editions of their own works. Henry Purcell is an obvious case. We have lots by his contemporary John Blow and nothing by Purcell himself. But the aim was to make this material widely available for libraries, for study, and also, critically, for performance. So among those who have served Musica Britannica on the committee and as editors have not only been academics, but also those who have played the music in public. And the first secretary, Thurston Dart, is a case in point.
Well, we've just heard a piece of Tallis from the Mulliner book. How was that decision made? Who made the decision to choose the Mulliner book as volume one?
You know, I think you've got me there. I was a schoolboy, what Sir Donald Tovey would call an inky schoolboy, in short trousers at that time. So the answer is I don't know, but a lot of what's got into Musica Britannica is because somebody has been working on a particular area. They've dug in a field and found buried treasure. My guess is the editor, Dennis Stevens, was working on the Mulliner book for his doctoral studies and presumably offered it to the edition, or they heard about it perhaps from one of the original committee members and called him up.
Well, you may have been an inky schoolboy at the time, but that's a pretty good answer, I think. I'm very happy to live with that. Well, for our next music, we're moving right on to Musica Britannica Volume 10, but we're going back a little in time to the 15th century and the Eton Choir book.
Thank you.
The 16, directed by Harry Christophers, in music from the Eton Choir Book, and Ave Maria by William Cornish. That was music from the 10th volume of Musica Britannica, a project begun in 1951 and originally intended to be no more than 10 volumes. With me for today's early music show is the man who's chaired the editorial committee since 1993, Professor Julian Rushton. Julian, why did they only think of 10 volumes at first? Was there just not enough material available?
There clearly was more than enough material available. I think they probably thought they would run out of money. Musica Britannica got a very generous grant in 1951 terms from the Arts Council of £500. But unlike certain of our contemporaries, we get no government funding otherwise. So we have to carry on by selling volumes in order to produce new ones.
So from the start, you were cutting your coat according to the financial cloth. But I'm very interested and impressed by the fact that it was always intended not just to work as a series of beautiful books for people to buy and look at, but to be played and sung from. Mm. Now, who was playing and singing early music in 1951?
Well, Thurston Dart, clearly, and indeed quite a few people. I think it all goes back further than we think. After all, the Dolmetscheres and so on are way back into the previous century, and that's no longer the last century, as I tend to think of it, but the 19th. So I think plenty of people were interested in earlier music.
Well, on the way here, Julian, you were mentioning that there was nearly a ghastly error of political correctness back in 1951, because the Royal Musical Association wanted Musica Britannica to be English music, derived from non-copyright sources earlier than the 20th century, which has not been made available to the public by commercial publishers. Well, the end of that sentence is fine, but it isn't just about English music, is it?
No, it's about British music, and we interpret it as widely as we can. And fairly early on, of course, we did produce a volume of music in Scotland, as well as fairly early, too, a volume of music by John Field, who was Irish.
And I see that you've also encouraged volumes of music by the children of immigrants, Ferrabosco and Storis or Storace, for example.
We consider them to be legitimate contributors to British music. Where young Storis is concerned, of course, we've recently published his full-length Italian opera written for Vienna, a volume of which I think we are justifiably proud.
Well, let's give a good hearty nod to the music of Scotland. This is music from volume 15, Robert Carver's O Bone Jesu.
Thank you.
Andrew Parrott directing the Taverner Choir in music by Robert Carver from Musica Britannica. And with me here at Stainer & Bell's offices, that's the publishers of Musica Britannica, is Julian Rushton. Julian, who were the scholars who undertook this work? You've mentioned Thurston Dart, but it's a great list of eminent names, well, including yours.
I like to open volume one and see Professor Anthony Lewis, general editor, Professor Edward J. Dent, Dr. Edmund H. Fellows, Frank Howes, Professor J. A. Westrop, and Thurston Dart. If I look at a more recent list, I can mention a few other people, the late Nigel Fortune and Gerald Abraham, Ivor Keyes, Andrew Parrott, indeed.
Among the many names, a tremendously distinguished list here, and I also want to put in a word for John Stevens of Magdalen, Cambridge, because it was his volume of medieval songs, I think, was the first Musica Britannica volume I really investigated in depth.
John, of course, was not actually on the committee, but he was the one who did the really hard work, because the really hard work is done by the editors, and the general editor especially.
Well, we've mainly heard choral music so far in this survey of Musica Britannica, but working through the volumes in order, alas, not able to include every single one of the 90, because that would take rather a lot of programmes, and we've only got one. We've reached volume 26, and Viol Music by John Jenkins. Now, Julian, John Jenkins, where does he fit in?
Jenkins is the most prolific mid-17th century composer. It's sometimes a mistake for composers to be too prolific, of course, because it's then easy to overlook how good they are. And he is indeed a terrific composer.
Well, Jenkins was particularly attached to writing about the town of Newark in Nottinghamshire, a very active town in the Civil War. And here is his Newark Galliard. Galliard by 17th century composer John Jenkins, played by Ensemble Jérôme Antaille. Julian, Musica Britannica was always intended to showcase the underdog. If you were Purcell,
yes,
you got quite enough attention from the Purcell Society and elsewhere, thank you very much. So you've said Blow rather than Purcell, Parry rather than Elgar. And Jenkins fits right in there because, as you've said, he's prolific. But maybe that didn't do him too much good. But our next composer is William Byrd, and I'd have thought he was pretty well served elsewhere by the time of his volumes, numbers 27 and 28.
Well, there is, of course, a parallel series called Early English Church Music, which does an enormous amount of repertoire that Musica Britannica would love to have because it's so very good. As far as Byrd is concerned, there's actually a complete edition of his works, but for some reason, which again is before my time on the committee, it was agreed that Musica Britannica, with Alan Brown as the editor, should publish his keyboard music. And this has been two volumes which have been revised by Alan and reprinted and are very successful and, of course, contain many wonderful works.
Well, let's hear some. David Moroney plays music by Byrd. Byrd's Callino Casturame, played by harpsichordist David Moroney. If you've just joined us, you're listening to The Early Music Show with me, Catherine Bott. Today, investigating the splendours of Musica Britannica, the national collection of music whose composers range in fame from Anon to Byrd, and in date from the Middle Ages to about 1900. And I'm indebted to my guest on today's programme, Julian Rushton, for that neat phrase that sums it up. Julian, the song repertoire is particularly important to me, because I can remember going back in the day to the Senate House Library of the University of London to leaf endlessly through the next volume we're going to hear about, which is volume 33, English Songs 1625 to 60. Do you ever get letters? I mean, I should have written one, really, because when I hit upon this volume, I wasn't long out of the Guildhall, and I discovered music that it really hadn't occurred to me, because I knew nothing about music in between the Elizabethans and the Restoration. And there was this treasure trove of songs. And I never wrote to say thank you to Musica Britannica, but I do hope that you are aware of an appreciative public from among professionals.
Well, I think so, yes. Partly through the Anthony Lewis Memorial Prize, of which our most recent distinguished visiting judge was Catherine Bott, where it's mostly been for singers and sometimes for keyboard players, where we've had David Moroney as a judge. And this prize includes not only a money prize, but the winner gets some free volumes of Musica Britannica. And this, we hope, will help to diffuse knowledge of the repertoire.
Let's hear something going back to those interesting years when Charles I still wore his head, as far as I know. This is Slide Soft, You Silver Floods by Henry Lawes.
Slide soft, you silver floods,
Robin Blaise and Elizabeth Kenny with Slide Soft, You Silver Floods by Henry Lawes from Musica Britannica, Volume 33. And Julian, one of the great treats of being here today at Stainer & Bell is that we're sitting at a table surrounded by volumes, and you've just opened a rather special one.
Yes, well, this is indeed English Songs 1625 to 1660, transcribed and edited by Ian Spink. And it's volume XXX111. Our habit remains of using Roman numerals. Beneath the name Ian Spink is this fascinating monograph in red ink, which says, if you unpick it, RTD71. That is, of course, Robert Thurston Dart, generally known to his friends as Bob, and sort of professionally as Thurston Dart, who at the time, of course, was the secretary of the edition. And a curious piece of paper, which signed, I think it's RTD, though it might be RLD, with the words, "Hope you are feeling better." And whether that was the strain upon Ian Spink of editing the volume that caused him to feel poorly, we could ask him, of course.
Well, perhaps when this programme is broadcast, we will find out.
Perhaps he'll tweet.
Fashions in musicology, we have to deal with them. This is 60 years of editing this music. Some composers have been revisited. Let's go back to the early days. What was editorial policy with regard to time signatures, note values, all those little things that can make music so difficult to access or so instantly readable?
I think there were three key words: modernise, modernise, modernise. It has to be presented in a form that people will recognise and feel they can understand and get around a table or whatever is the relevant positioning of performers and get into. And as you did with the English songs, discover what beauties are there.
You have written somewhere that it's really very neat and tidy if you can find composers whose works fit neatly into just one volume. But not everybody makes life easy like that. You can't compartmentalise because, for example, volume 64 alone is the third volume of music by John Blow. Why is John Blow so deserving? And then I'm asking a question that I think I know the answer to. Why is he so deserving of Musica Britannica's attentions?
I think because he is almost as great as Henry Purcell, and both, remarkably enough, preceded and followed him on the organ of Westminster Abbey. His music is astonishing. There are now four volumes of Blow's sacred music in Musica Britannica, two volumes of his keyboard music as well. So, yes, he's not going to get a complete edition because we've almost done it.
Well, this is from volume 64, his anthem, Cry Aloud and Spare Not.
Thank you.
tenors Joseph Cornwell and William Kendall and bass Stephen Alder, the choir of Winchester Cathedral and the parley of instruments directed by David Hill in John Blow's anthem Cry Aloud and Spare Not. And Julian Rushton, sometimes composers exceed all expectations and write extraordinary repertoire, but are eclipsed because they happen to be around when somebody whom posterity loves more is also around.
I think you're thinking of Handel.
Yes, now, and William Boyce.
Exactly. Handel, the story always used to be that English music or British music was essentially rubbed out by Handel. Everybody played Handel and nobody else was doing anything of interest at all. And one of Music Britannica's achievements, I think, is to present the evidence that this is not so in the work of Croft, Green and William Boyce.
Mm. Now, we're going to hear from Solomon, not Handel's Solomon, but William Boyce's Solomon. And this is a rather extraordinary piece. I mean, Handel's Solomon is an oratorio. We're talking about the Judgment of Solomon. Boyce, we have the volume in front of us, he calls Solomon a serenata, which is all rather sort of frivolous and worldly, it seems to me.
It's an Italian work, and a serenata often meant a work that was essentially a one-act opera, not too heavy. I don't know whether this was actually meant to be staged or rather performed as a cantata. I think that's more likely. But rather than dealing with the grandeur of Solomon and the visit of the Queen of Sheba,
and the great judgment and all that.
And
sort
of
thing.
Course, the judgment of Solomon, never mind his marital affairs either, this is actually an erotic work, a love duet. And the text is taken from the Song of Solomon. And the characters in it are just called he and she.
Arise,
the duet Arise My Fair, The Doors Unfold, and the very necessary he and she there were Howard Crook and Bronwyn Mills, with the Parley of Instruments directed by Peter Holman. And that was music from Boyce's Solomon, the subject of volume 68 of Musica Britannica. And of course this year is the tercentenary of his birth, and you can bet that the Early Music Show will be delving into William Boyce a little later in the year. Julian, Stainer and Bell have been involved right from the start. What does Musica Britannica owe this firm?
Well, just a huge amount. They have been very understanding as publishers, patient, kind, and also well informed, in addition to which, of course, they agree to go on, publish our material. They handle matters like off-prints and publication of parts, some of which are simply printed on demand, which is, of course, a new kind of service in the digital age, and one of which we intend to take full advantage.
So there's really no end in sight. Musica Britannica can go on and on. Would you say that Musica Britannica has actually saved quite a lot of music that otherwise would be unknown to us now?
We may have saved some music. What we've certainly done, or we've always aimed to do, is to rescue it from unjustified neglect.
Well, it's time for our last composer. We're going to go to volume 91 of Musica Britannica, scheduled for publication in September this year. And it's the music of William Croft, dear to my heart, because he and I are both from Warwickshire. How much does he yield to your editors?
Well, I'm looking at a copy of volume 88, which is called William Croft Complete Chamber Music. So there is something complete in one volume, edited by our general editor, Harry Dyke Johnston. We have this one upcoming, and, well, there may well be one more. He's one of these fairly prolific 18th century composers. I don't know whether he had particular leisure to compose. I believe he has quite aristocratic connections. So it's possible that he didn't actually have to do hack work all the time.
Which should mean that his music's better, because he's not turning it out just to a deadline.
Ah, that doesn't that's, follow.
That's a subject for a whole different edition of the programme, I think. Well, it's been a real treat to sit surrounded by these volumes that have meant so much to me in my career, and I'm sure any early music professional listening will go along with that. So, Julian, thank you very much for making the journey to come and talk to me about this magnificent series. We'll end with music by William Croft. Let's go back to volume 88 of Musica Britannica and hear Charivari Agréable with a sonata for four violins and continuo.
William Croft's Sonata for Four Violins and Continuo, played by Charivari Agréable, directed by Kaming Ng. And that ends today's Early Music Show, which was presented by Catherine Bott in conversation with Julian Rushton, the chairman of the editorial committee of Musica Britannica. And Musica Britannica is again on the agenda in tomorrow's Early Music Show at 1 o'clock, when Catherine will be back with a live edition from this year's York Early Music Festival and featuring some of the madrigals from The Triumphs of Oriana, performed live by the King's Singers. Well, I say Catherine will be back tomorrow. In fact, she's back now with a second opportunity to hear Monday's Radio 3 lunchtime concert.
Welcome to Wigmore Hall and a recital given by a pianist who's long been recognised worldwide as a player of virtuosity and poetic poise, Imogen Cooper. In an interview a couple of years ago, she described how she discovered the piano. I climbed onto the piano stool when I was 3, started mucking about and thought, this is the thing for me. And at the age of just 12, she went alone to study at the Paris Conservatoire. In today's recital, Imogen Cooper will play Beethoven's D minor sonata, Opus 31, No. 2, traditionally known as The Tempest, and a nocturne and a ballade by Chopin. She begins with four preludes from Debussy's second collection, first performed in Paris in 1913. And before I give you their titles, I can't do better than quote Imogen Cooper's own words about these ravishing pianistic impressions. She says, "I've chosen them primarily because of the contrast within themselves. The titles of each are put in brackets at the end of the piece rather than the top, which would be the normal thing to do. The brackets signify that this is only an idea as to what the piece is about and doesn't necessarily have to influence the player's imagination. But if he composed it with those images in mind, then that's good enough for me." So, to begin her recital with four preludes by Debussy, which conjure up, in turn, mists, the moonlit terrace, the wine gate of the Alhambra, and finally a study in alternating thirds, we welcome to the Wigmore Hall platform, Imogen Cooper.